with revulsion when she saw us. "What are they doing to you?" "Making us dig," said Mother, pushing her mud-encrusted hair away from her face. "In the rain." "Quickly," she said, pulling us toward her. Her hands trembled. "I could be in awful trouble taking risks like this for you. I hope you know that." She reached into her brassiere and pulled out a few small beets and passed them quickly to Mother. She then raised her dress and took two more from her underwear. "Now hurry, go," she said. I heard the bald man yelling in the shack behind us. We scurried back to our hut to begin our feast. I was too hungry to care that I hated beets. I didn't even care that they had been transported in someone's sweaty underwear. Chapter 35. "Lina, put this in your pocket and take it to Mr. Stallus," said Mother, handing me a beet. The bald man. I couldn't. I just couldn't do it. "Mother, I'm too tired." I lay on the planks, my cheek flushed to the wood. "I brought some straw for us to sleep on," announced Jonas. "The woman told me where I could find it. I'll bring more tomorrow," he said. "Lina, hurry before it gets too dark. Take it to Mr. Stallus," said Mother, organizing the straw with Jonas. I walked into the bald man's shack. A woman and two wailing babies took up most of the gray space. Mr. Stallus was cramped in the corner, his broken leg splinted with a board.
"What took you so long?" he said. "Are you trying to starve me? Are you in cahoots with them? What torture, crying day and night? I'd trade the rotting baby for this rubbish."
I dropped the beet onto his lap and turned to leave.
"What happened to your hands?" he said. "They're disgusting." "I've been working all day," I snapped. "Unlike you." "What do they have you doing?" he asked.
"Digging holes," I said.
"Digging, eh?" he mumbled. "Interesting. I thought they'd have pulled your mother."
"What do you mean?" I asked.
"Your mother is a smart woman. She studied in Moscow. The damn Soviets know everything about us. They know about our families. Don't think they won't take advantage of that."
I thought about Papa. I need to get word to my father so he can find us.
"Find you? Don't be stupid," he scoffed.
"He will. He'll know how to find us. You don't know my father," I said. The bald man looked down.
"Do you? Have those guards gotten to you and your mother yet?"
he asked. I looked at him.
"Between your legs, have they gotten to you yet?"
I huffed in disgust. I couldn't take it anymore. I left him and walked out of the hut.
"Hey."
I turned toward the voice. Andrus was leaning up against the shack. "Hi," I said, looking over to him.
"You look horrible," he said.
I was too exhausted to muster a clever reply. I nodded.
"What are they having you do?"
"We're digging holes," I said. "Jonas made shoes all day."
"I cut trees in the forest," he said.
Andrus looked dirty, but untouched by the guards. His face and arms were tan, making his eyes appear very blue. I pulled a clump of dirt from my hair. "Which shack are you in?" I asked.
"Somewhere over there," he said, without motioning in any particular direction. "Are you digging with that blonde NKVD?
"With him? That's a joke. He's not digging," I said. "He just stands around smoking and yelling at us."
"His name is Kretsky," said Andrus. "The commander? He's Komarov. I'm trying to find out more."
"Where are you getting information? Is there any news of the men?" I asked, thinking of Papa. He shook his head. "There's supposed to be a village nearby with a post office," I said. "Have you heard that? I want to send a letter to my cousin."
"The Soviets will read everything you write. They've got people to translate, so be careful what you say."
I looked down, thinking of the NKVD asking Mother to be a translator. Our personal correspondence wasn't personal. Privacy was but a memory. It wasn't even rationed like sleep or bread. I thought about telling Andrus that the NKVD had asked Mother to spy.
"Here,"
he said, holding out his hand.
He opened his palm to reveal 3 cigarettes.
You're giving me cigarettes? I asked.
Well, what did you think? That I had a roasted duck in my pocket?
No, I meant, thank you.
Sure. They're for your brother and your mother. Are they doing okay?
I nodded, kicking at the dirt. Where'd you get the cigarettes? I asked.
Around.
How's your mom?
Fine, he said quickly. Look, I gotta go. Tell Jonas I said hi. And try not to ruin the cigarettes with your blister juice, he teased. I staggered back to our shack, trying to see which way Andrus went.
Where was his hut?
I gave Mother the 3 cigarettes.
From Andrus, I said.
How sweet of him, said Mother.
Where did he get them?
You saw Andrus? Said Jonas. Is he okay?
He's okay. He chopped wood all day in the forest. He said to tell you hello. The Altean woman toddled over and thrust her hand out to Mother. They had a brief exchange, interspersed with niets and stomps from the Altean woman's foot.
Elena, said Mother, pointing to her own chest. Lina?
Jonas, she said, pointing to us.
Ulyushka,
the woman said, thrusting her palm to Mother. Mother gave her a cigarette.
Why are you giving her a cigarette? Asked Jonas.
She says it's payment toward rent, said Mother.
Her name is Ulyushka.
Is that her first or last name? I asked.
I don't know, but if we're to live here, we must be able to address one another properly.
I arranged my raincoat over some of the straw that Jonas had brought. I lay down. I hated the way Mother had said, if we're to live here, like we were staying. I also heard Mother say, spasiba, which meant thank you in Russian. I looked over and saw her sharing a match with Ulyushka. Mother pulled 2 graceful puffs through her long fingers and then put it out quickly, rationing her own cigarette.
Lina, whispered Jonas. Did Andrus look okay?
He looked fine, I said, thinking of his tan face. I was lying in bed waiting for the sound. I heard soft footsteps outside. The curtain billowed up, revealing Joanna's tanned face in the window.
Come out, she said. Let's sit on the porch.
I crept out of our bedroom and onto the porch of the cottage. Joanna draped askew in the rocker, gliding back and forth. I sat in the chair next to her, pulling my knees up and tucking my bare feet under my cotton nightgown. The rocker croaked a steady rhythm while Joanna stared off into the darkness.
So, how was it? I asked.
He's wonderful, she sighed.
Really? I said. Is he smart? He's not one of those dumb boys who drinks beer at the beach all day, is he?
Oh, no, she breathed. He's in his first year at university. He wants to study engineering.
And he doesn't have a girlfriend? I asked.
Lina, stop trying to find something wrong with him.
I'm not. I'm just asking, I said.
One day someone will catch your eye, Lina, and hopefully when it happens, you won't be so critical.
I'm not critical, I said. I just want to make sure he's good enough for you.
He has a younger brother, said Joanna, grinning at me.
Really?
I crinkled my nose.
See, you're already critical and you haven't even met him.
I'm not being critical. So where is this younger brother?
He'll be here next week. Do you want to meet him?
I don't know. Maybe. It depends what he's like, I said.
Well, you won't know until you meet him, will you? Teased Joanna.
Chapter 36. We were asleep when it happened. I had rinsed off my blisters and started a letter to Joanna, but I was too tired. I fell asleep. The next thing I knew, the NKVD was yelling at me, pushing me to get outside.
Mother, what's happening? Said Jonas.
They say we must report to the Kolkhoz office immediately.
Dubai!
Shouted a guard holding a lantern. They became impatient. One drew a pistol.
Da! Yes! Said Mother.
Hurry, children, move! We scrambled out of our straw. Ilyushka rolled over, turning her back to us. I looked over to my suitcase, grateful I had hidden my drawings. Others were also herded from their huts. We walked in a line down the dirt path toward the Kolkhoz office. I heard the bald man yelling somewhere behind us. They packed us into the main room of the log building. The gray-haired man who wound his watch stood in the corner. The little girl with the dolly waved excitedly to me as if reunited with a long-lost friend. A wide bruise blossomed across her cheek. We were instructed to wait quietly until the others arrived. The log walls were chinked with gray paste. At the head of the room, a desk with a black chair took up much of the floor. Portraits of Marx, Engels, Lenin, and Stalin hung above the desk. Yosif Vissarionovich Jugosvilia. He called himself Joseph Stalin, which meant Man of Steel. I stared at the picture. He seemed to stare back. His right eyebrow arched, challenging me. I looked at his bushy mustache and dark, stony eyes. The portrait showed him almost smirking. Was that intentional? I wondered about the artists who painted Stalin. Were they grateful to be in his presence, or terrified of the outcome if he found their portraits unbecoming? The picture of Stalin was crooked. The door opened. The bald man hobbled in on his broken leg.
"And not one of you thought to help me," he yelled.
Komarov, the commander, marched in, followed by several NKVD carrying rifles. The blonde guard, Kretsky, was at the end of the line carrying a stack of papers. How did Andrus learn their names? I looked around for Andrus and his mother. They weren't there. Komarov began speaking. Everyone turned toward mother. The commander paused and raised his eyebrow at her, twirling the ever-present toothpick on his tongue. Mother's face tightened. "He says we've been brought here for paperwork."
"Paperwork," said Mrs. Rimmis. "At this hour?"
Komarov continued speaking. Kretsky held up a typewritten document. "We are all to sign that document," said Mother. "What does it say?" the crowd demanded. "It says three things," said Mother, staring at Komarov. He continued speaking, with Mother translating in between for the group. "First, we sign that we agree to join this collective farm." There were rumbles within the room. People turned back to the commander as he spoke. His arm casually moved his uniform aside, displaying the gun at his hip. The crowd shifted. "Second," said Mother, "we sign that we agree to pay a war tax of 200 rubles per person, children included."
"Where are we to get 200 rubles?" said the bald man. "They've already stolen all that we had."
Chattering ensued. An NKVD pounded the butt of his rifle on the desk. The room quieted. I looked at Komarov as he spoke. He stared straight at Mother, as if he were deeply enjoying what he was saying to her. Mother paused. Her mouth sagged.
"Well, what is it?
What's the third, Elena?" said Mrs. Rimmis. "We agree that we are criminals." Mother paused. "And that our sentence shall be 25 years hard labor." Shouts and wails erupted in the small room. Someone began to hyperventilate. The crowd pushed forward toward the desk, arguing. The NKVD lifted their rifles, pointing them at us. My jaw unlatched. 25 years. We were going to be imprisoned for 25 years? That meant I would be older than Mother when we were released. I reached out to Jonas to steady myself. He wasn't there. He had collapsed at my feet. I couldn't pull a deep breath. The room began to fold in around me. I was sliding, tangled in panic's undertow.
"Silence!"
yelled a male voice. Everyone turned. It was the gray-haired man who wound his watch.
"Calm yourselves," he said slowly. "We do no good by becoming hysterical. We can't think clearly if we panic. It's scaring the children."
I looked at the little girl with the dolly. She clung to her mother's dress, tears spilling onto her bruised face. The man lowered his voice and spoke calmly.
We are intelligent, dignified people. That is why they have deported us. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Alexandris Lucas. I am an attorney from Kaunas.
The crowd quieted. Mother and I helped Jonas to his feet. The commander, Komarov, yelled from the desk at the front of the room.
Mrs. Vilkas, please tell the commander that I am explaining the situation to our friends, said Mr. Lucas.
Mother translated. Kretsky, the young blonde guard, chewed his thumbnail.
I'm not signing any document, said Miss Scribus. They made us sign a registration document at the teachers' conference. Look where it got me. That's how they collected the names of all the teachers to deport.
They'll kill us if we don't sign, said the grouchy woman.
I don't believe so, said the gray-haired man. Not before winter. We are in the first week of August. There is much work to be done. We are good, strong workers. We are farming for them, building structures for them. It is to their benefit to use us, at least until winter comes.
He's right, said the bald man. First, they'll grind us from grain to flour. Then they'll kill us. Who wants to wait around for that? Not me.
They shot the girl who had the baby, huffed the grouchy woman.
They shot Ona because she lost her senses, said Mr. Lucas. She was out of control. We are not out of control. We are intelligent, rational people.
So we shouldn't sign? Someone asked.
No. I believe we should sit down in an orderly manner. Mrs. Vilkas will explain that we are not ready to sign paperwork.
Not ready, said Mrs. Rimmis.
I agree, said Mother. We must not completely refuse, and we must show that we are not hysterical. Form three lines.
The NKVD held up their rifles, unsure of what we might do. We sat down in straight lines in front of the desk under portraits of Russia's leaders. The guards looked at one another dumbfounded. We sat calmly. We had regained a slice of dignity. I put my arm around Jonas.
Mrs. Vilkas, please ask Commander Komarov what the charges are, said the gray-haired man.
Mother translated. Komarov sat on the edge of the desk, swinging his boot.
He says we are charged under Article 58 of the Soviet Penal Code for counter-revolutionary activities against the USSR, said Mother.
That doesn't carry a 25-year sentence, muttered the bald man.
Tell him we will work for them and we will provide good labor, but we are not yet ready to sign, said Mr. Lucas.
Mother translated.
He says we must sign now. I'm not signing a paper condemning me to 25 years, said Miss Grievous.
Nor am I said.
So what do we do? Asked Mrs. Remus.
We wait here quietly until we are dismissed, said Mr. Lucas, winding his watch.
And so we waited.
Where's Andris? Whispered Jonas.
I don't know, I said. I had heard the bald man ask the same question. We sat on the floor of the Kolkhoz office. Every few minutes, Komarov would slap or kick someone, trying to bully them into signing. No one did. I winced with his every step. Sweat trickled across the nape of my neck and along my spine. I tried to keep my head down, afraid that Komarov would notice me. Those who fell asleep were beaten. Hours passed. We sat obediently, like schoolchildren in front of the principal. Finally, Komarov spoke to Kretsky.
He's telling the young guard to take over, Mother translated.
Komarov marched over to Mother. He grabbed her by the arm and spit something that resembled an oyster onto her face. Then he left.
Mother quickly wiped off the slime as if it didn't bother her at all.
It bothered me. I wanted to roll the hate up into my mouth and spit it back in his face.
Chapter 37. At sunrise, they told us it was time to go back to work. Tired but relieved, we dragged ourselves to our shack.
Ilyushka was already gone. The hut smelled of rotten eggs. We drank some of the rainwater and ate a stub of bread Mother had saved. Despite my washing efforts, my dress was stiff with mud. My hands looked like a small animal had chewed on them. Yellow pus leaked from the blisters. I tried my best to clean the sores with the rainwater. It didn't help. Mother said I needed to form calluses. "Just do the best you can, dear," said Mother. "Move your arm as if you're digging, but don't press. I'll do the work." We set off out of the hut, walking toward the lineup for work detail. Mrs. Rimmis walked toward us, her face covered in fear. Then I saw it. The body of a man with a stake driven through his chest into the side of the kolkhoz office. His arms and legs dangled like a limp marionette. Blood soaked through his shirt and dripped to form a stain beneath him. Buzzards feasted on his fleshy bullet wounds. One pecked at his empty eye socket. "Who is he?" I asked. Mother gasped, grabbed me, and tried to cover my eyes. "He wrote a letter," whispered Mrs. Rimmis. I moved past Mother, looking at the piece of paper tacked up, fluttering next to the dead man. I saw handwriting in a very crude diagram. "He wrote a letter to the partisans, the Lithuanian freedom fighters. The NKVD found it," said Mrs. Rimmis. "Who translated it for them?" whispered Mother. Mrs. Rimmis shrugged. My stomach dropped, thinking of my drawings. I felt nauseous and put my hand to my mouth. The blonde guard, Kretzky, stared at me. He looked tired and angry. Our standoff had deprived him of sleep. He marched us out to the clearing at a faster pace than normal, yelling and pushing at us. We arrived at the large pit we had dug the day before. Looking at it, I estimated that four men lying down could fit inside. Kretzky instructed us to dig another pit next to the first. I couldn't erase the image of the dead man from my mind. His diagram was nothing more than a few crude lines. I thought of my drawings, lifelike and full of pain, sitting in my suitcase. I had to hide them. I yawned and hacked away at the dirt. Mother said the time went faster if we talked about things that made us happy. She said it gave us strength. "I want to find that village," I said. "Maybe we can buy food or send letters." "How can we go anywhere when all we do is work?" said the grouchy woman. "And if we don't work, we don't eat."
"I'll try to ask the woman I live with," said Mrs. Rimmis.
"Be careful who you ask," said Mother. "We don't know who we can trust." I missed Papa. He would know who we could ask and who we should stay away from. We dug and dug until the water arrived. Commander Komarov was on the truck. He walked around the holes, inspecting them. I eyed the bucket of water. My hair stuck to my face. I wanted to submerge my head and drink. Komarov barked a command. Kretzky shifted his feet. Komarov repeated the command. Mother's face was suddenly the color of chalk. "He says, we must get in the first hole," she said, clenching her dress.
"For what?"
I asked. Komarov yelled and pulled a pistol from his belt. He pointed it at Mother. She jumped down into the first hole. The pistol moved to my head. I jumped in. He continued until all four of us were in the hole. He laughed and gave another instruction. "We must put our hands on our heads," said Mother.
"No, dear God," said Mrs. Rimmis, shaking.
Komarov walked around the hole, looking at us, pointing the pistol. He told us to lie down. We lay next to each other. Mother grasped my hand. I stared up. The sky was blue behind the silhouette of his large square frame. He circled the hole again.
"I love you, Lina," whispered Mother.
"Our Father who art in heaven," began Mrs. Rimmis. Bang! He shot into the hole. Dirt crumbled down from above our heads. Mrs. Rimmis screamed. Komarov told us to shut up. He circled around and around, muttering that we were disgusting pigs. Suddenly, he began kicking dirt from the large pile into the hole. He laughed and kicked faster and faster.
The soil landed on my feet, then on my dress, then on my chest. He kicked furiously, covering us in dirt, still pointing the gun at our faces. If I sat up, I'd be shot. If I didn't sit up, I'd be buried alive. I closed my eyes. A heavy load of dirt sat on my body. Then finally, dirt fell onto my face. Bang! More dirt crumbled above our heads. Komarov laughed wildly, kicking dirt onto our faces. Dirt covered my nose. I opened my mouth to breathe and choked on the soil. I heard Komarov cackling and then hacking. He laughed and coughed, trying to regain composure as if he had outdone himself. Kretzky said something. Bang! Then it was quiet. We lay there, buried in our own efforts. I heard a muffled rumble of the truck driving away. I couldn't open my eyes. I felt Mother squeezing my hand. She was still alive. I squeezed back. Then I heard Kretzky's voice above us. Mother sat up and frantically began wiping dirt from my face. She pulled me up. I hugged her, not wanting to let go. Mrs. Rimmis dug the grouchy woman out. She wheezed and coughed up dirt. "It's okay, darling," said Mother, rocking me into her. "He's just trying to scare us. He wants us to sign those documents." I couldn't cry. I couldn't even speak.
"Davai," said Kretzky softly. He reached out his hand. I looked up at his outstretched arm. I hesitated. He reached down farther. I grabbed his forearm. He grasped mine. I dug my toe into the dirt and let him pull me out. I stood at the side of the hole face to face with Kretzky. We stared at each other.
"Get me out of here!" yelled the grouchy woman. I looked away where the truck had driven off. Kretzky sent us back to digging. No one spoke for the rest of the day. Chapter 38.
"What's wrong?" asked Jonas when we arrived back at the shack.
"Nothing, dear," said Mother.
Jonas looked from Mother to me, searching our faces for answers.
"We're just tired."
Mother smiled.
"Just tired," I told Jonas.
Jonas motioned us over to his pallet of straw. Inside his small cap were three large potatoes. He put his finger to his lips so our gasps wouldn't be audible. He didn't want Ilyushka to take the potatoes for rent.
"Where did you get them?" I whispered.
"Darling, thank you," said Mother. "And I think we have just enough rainwater left. We'll make a nice potato soup."
Mother grabbed the coat out of her suitcase. "I'll be right back."
"Where are you going?" I asked.
"To take food to Mr. Stalas," she said. I checked my suitcase, thinking of the dead man knifed up against the Kolkhoz office. My drawings were undisturbed. The lining on the bottom of my suitcase was held down by snaps. I tore each drawing and page of writing from my tablet, slid it under the lining, and snapped it back in place. I would hide my messages to Papa until I found a way to send something. I helped Jonas set the water to boil. Then it occurred to me. Miss Grebus wasn't able to give us beets today. Mother didn't take a potato. So what was she feeding the bald man? I walked through the huts and quickly ducked out of sight. Mother was talking to Andrus in front of the bald man's shack. She was no longer holding her coat. I couldn't hear their conversation. Andrus looked concerned. He discreetly handed a bundle to Mother. She reached out and patted his shoulder. Andrus turned to leave. I ducked behind the shack. Once Mother passed, I peeked out and began to follow him. Andrus walked down the row of barracks. I stayed well behind, just close enough to see where he was going. He made his way to the edge of the camp, then continued on to a large log building with windows. He stopped and looked around. I ducked behind the edge of a shack. It looked like Andrus entered the building from the rear. I crept closer and hid behind a bush. I squinted to peer in the window. A group of NKVD sat around a table. I looked to the back of the building. No,
Andrus couldn't have gone inside an NKVD building. I was just about to follow him farther, then I saw her. Mrs. Arvidus appeared in the window carrying a tray of glasses. Her hair was clean and styled. Her clothes were pressed. She was wearing makeup. She smiled and distributed the drinks to the NKVD. Andrus and his mother were working with the Soviets. Chapter 39. I should have been grateful for the potato soup that night, but all I could think about was Andrus. How could he do it? How could he work with them? Did he live in that building? I thought about lying in that hole while Andrus lay in a bed, a Soviet bed. I kicked at my itchy straw, staring at the rusted ceiling. Mother, do you think they'll let us sleep tonight, or will they insist we go to the office to sign the papers? Asked Jonas. I don't know, said Mother. She turned her head to me. Andrus gave me that nice bread we had with our soup. It's very courageous of him to take risks like that for us. Oh, he's courageous, isn't he? What do you mean by that? Said Jonas. He is courageous. He gets us food nearly every day. He sure looks like he's eating well, doesn't he? I think he's actually gained weight, I said. And be glad of that, said Mother. Be glad that not everyone is desperate for food like we are. Yes, I'm very glad the NKVD aren't hungry. If they were hungry, how would they have the strength to bury us alive? I said. What? Said Jonas. Ilyushka yelled at us to be quiet. Hush, Lina. Let's say our prayers and give thanks for that wonderful meal. Let's pray that your father is just as well. We slept through the night. The next morning, Officer Kretzky told Mother that we were to join the other women in the beet fields. I was thrilled. We bent and thrashed amongst the long green rows of sugar beets, using hoes without handles. Miss Grebus lectured us on the pace of our work. She told us that on the first day, someone leaned on the handle a moment to wipe their brow. The Soviets made them saw the handles off. I realized how difficult it was for Miss Grebus to steal beets for us. Armed guards stood watch. Although they seemed more interested in smoking and telling jokes, slipping a beet into my underwear unnoticed was no easy task. It poked out like an extra limb. That evening, I refused to take food to Mr. Stalas. I told Mother I felt too sick to walk. I couldn't stand to see Andrus. He was a traitor. He was plump on Soviet food, eating from the hand that strangled us each and every day. I'll take Mr. Stalas his food, said Jonas after a few days. Lina, go with him, said Mother. I don't want him to go alone. I walked with Jonas to the bald man's shack. Andrus was waiting outside. Hi, he said. I ignored him, left Jonas outside, and walked in to give Mr. Stalas his beets. He was standing up.
There you are! Where have you been?
He said, leaning up against the wall. I noticed Mother's coat tucked into his bed of straw. Disappointed I'm not dead? I said, handing him the beets.
That's a sour mood, he said.
Are you the only one who's allowed to be angry? I'm sick of this. I'm tired of the NKVD hounding us.
Bah, they don't care if we sign, said the bald man. Do you really think they need our permission, our signatures, to do what they're going to do to us? Stalin needs to break our will. Don't you understand? He knows if we sign some stupid papers, we'll give up. He'll break us.
How do you know? I asked.
He waved me away. It doesn't look good on you. Anger, he said. Now get out.
I walked out of the shack. Let's go, Jonas. Wait, whispered Jonas, leaning into me. He brought us salami! I folded my arms across my chest.
I guess she's allergic to kindness, said Andrus.
That's not what I'm allergic to. Where did you get your salami? I said. Andrus stared at me.
Jonas, can you leave us for a minute? He said.
No, he can't leave us. My mother doesn't want him to be alone. That's the only reason I came, I said. I'm fine, said Jonas. He turned and walked away.
So is that what you're eating these days?
I asked.
Soviet salami?
When I can get it, he said. He took out a cigarette and lit it. Andrus looked stronger, his arms muscular. He drew in a breath and blew out a plume of smoke over our heads.
And cigarettes, too, I commented. Are you sleeping in a nice bed in that Soviet building?
You have no idea, he said.
I don't? Well, you don't look tired or hungry. You weren't dragged to the Kolkhoz office in the middle of the night and condemned to 25 years. So are you reporting all of our conversations to them? You think I'm spying? Komarov asked Mother to spy and report to him. She said no.
You don't know what you're talking about, said Andrus, the crimson in his face rising.
I don't?
No, you have no idea, he said.
I don't see your mother working in the dirt.
No, said Andrus, leaning in an inch from my face. You know why? A vein in his temple bulged. I felt his breath on my forehead.
Yes, because...
Because they threatened to kill me unless she slept with them. And if they get tired of her, they still might kill me. So how would you feel, Lina, if your mother felt she had to prostitute herself to save your life?
My jaw dropped. The words flew out of his mouth.
How do you think my father would feel if he knew? How does my mother feel, lying with the men who murdered her husband? No, your mother might not translate for them, but what do you think she'd do if they held a knife to your brother's neck?
Andrus, I...
No! You have no idea. You have no idea how much I hate myself for putting my mother through this. How every day I think of ending my life so she can be free. But instead... My mother and I are using our misfortune to keep others alive. But you wouldn't understand that, would you? You're too selfish and self-centered. Poor you, digging all day long. You're just a spoiled kid.
He turned and walked away.
Chapter 40.
The straw prickled against my face. Jonas had fallen asleep a long time ago. A soft whistle blew each time he exhaled. I tossed and turned.
He's trying, Lina, said Mother.
He's sleeping, I said.
Andrus, he's trying and you're blocking him at every pass. Men aren't always graceful, you know.
Mother, you don't understand, I said.
She ignored me and continued.
Well, I can see that you're upset. Jonas said that you were nasty to Andrus. That's unfair. Sometimes kindness can be delivered in a clumsy way, but it's far more sincere in its clumsiness than those distinguished men you read about in books. Your father was very clumsy.
A tear rolled down my cheek. She chuckled in the darkness.
He says I bewitched him the very instant he saw me. But do you know what really happened? He tried to talk to me and fell out of a tree. He fell out of an oak tree and broke his arm.
Mother, it's not like that, I said.
Kostas, she sighed. He was so clumsy, but he was so sincere. Sometimes there is such beauty in awkwardness. There's love and emotion trying to express itself, but at the time, it just ends up being awkward. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm, I said, trying to muffle my tears.
Good men are often more practical than pretty, said Mother. Andrus just happens to be both.
I couldn't sleep. Each time I closed my eyes, I saw him winking at me. His beautiful face coming toward mine. The smell of his hair lingered around me.
Are you awake?
I whispered. Joanna rolled over.
Yes,
It's too hot to sleep, she said. I feel like I'm spinning. He's so handsome, I told her. She giggled, tucking her arms under her pillow. And he dances even better than his older brother. How did we look together? I asked. Like you were having a great time, she said. Everyone could see that. I can't wait to see him tomorrow, I sighed. He's just perfect. The next day after lunch, we ran back to the cottage to brush our hair. I nearly ran over Jonas on my way out. Where are you going? He asked. For a walk, I said, rushing after Joanna. I walked as fast as I could without breaking into a jog. I tried not to crumple the drawing rolled in my hand. I had decided to draw him when I couldn't sleep. The portrait came out so well that Joanna suggested I give it to him. She assured me he'd be impressed with my talent. His brother rushed up to Joanna, meeting her in the street.
Hey, stranger, he said, smiling at Joanna.
Hi, said Joanna.
Hi, Lina. What do you have there? He said, motioning to the paper in my hand.
Joanna looked over toward the ice cream shop. I moved around her to find him. Lina, she said, reaching out to hold me back.
It was too late. I had already seen.
My prince had his arm around a girl with red hair. They were cozy, laughing, sharing an ice cream cone. My stomach plunged and twisted. I forgot something, I said, backing away. My fingers wrenched the portrait in my sweaty hand. I'll be right back. I'll come with you, said Joanna. No, that's all right, I said, hoping the blotches of heat I felt on my neck weren't visible. I attempted a smile. The sides of my mouth trembled. I turned and walked away, trying to keep my composure until I reached a safe distance. Clenching my jaw didn't stop the tears. I stopped and leaned against a trash can on the street. Lina! Joanna caught up to me. Are you all right? I nodded. I opened the crinkled portrait of his handsome face. I ripped it up and threw it away. Stray pieces escaped my grip and blew across the street. Boys were idiots. They were all idiots.
Chapter 41. Autumn approached. The NKVD pushed us harder. If we so much as stumbled, they reduced our bread rations. Mother could close her thumb and middle finger around my forearm. I had no tears. The sensation of crying would fill me, but my eyes would only dry heave and burn. It was hard to imagine that war raged somewhere in Europe. We had a war of our own, waiting for the NKVD to choose the next victim, to throw us in the next hole. They enjoyed hitting and kicking us in the fields. One morning, they caught an old man eating a beet. A guard ripped out his front teeth with pliers. They made us watch. Every other night, they woke us to sign the documents, sentencing us to 25 years. We learned to sit in front of Komarov's desk and rest with our eyes open. I managed to escape the NKVD while sitting right in front of them. My art teacher had said that if you breathed deeply and imagined something, you could be there. You could see it, feel it. During our standoffs with the NKVD, I learned to do that. I clung to my rusted dreams during the times of silence. It was at gunpoint that I fell into every hope and allowed myself to wish from the deepest part of my heart. Komarov thought he was torturing us, but we were escaping into a stillness within ourselves. We found strength there. Not everyone could sit still. People became restless, exhausted. Finally, some gave in.
Traitors,
spit Miss Grebus under her breath, clucking her tongue. People argued about those who signed. The first night someone signed, I was furious. Mother told me to feel sorry for the person, that they had been pushed over the edge of their identity. I couldn't feel sorry for them. I couldn't understand. Walking to the fields each morning,
I could predict who would be the next to sign. Their faces sang songs of defeat. Mother saw it too. She would chat with the person and work next to them in the field, trying to bolster their spirit. Sometimes it worked. Many times it didn't. At night, I drew portraits of those who had signed and wrote about how the NKVD broke them down. The NKVD's hostilities strengthened my defiance. Why would I give in to people who spit in my face and tormented me each and every day? What would I have left if I gave them my self-respect? I wondered what would happen if we were the only ones left who wouldn't sign. The bald man moaned that we could believe no one. He accused everyone of being a spy. Trust crumbled. People began to question each other's motives and planted seeds of doubt. I thought of Papa, telling me to be careful with my drawing. 2 nights later, the grouchy woman signed the papers. She bent over the desk. The pen trembled in her knobby hand. I thought she might change her mind, but suddenly she scribbled something and threw the pen down, committing herself and her little girls to 25 years. We stared at her. Mother bit her bottom lip and looked down. The grouchy woman began screaming, telling us we were imbeciles, that we were all going to die, so why didn't we eat well until then? One of her daughters began to cry. That night, I drew her face. Her mouth sagged, forlorn. The lines of her brow plunged with both anger and confusion. Mother and Mrs. Rimmis scavenged for news of the men or the war. Andrus passed information to Jonas. He ignored me. Mother wrote letters to Papa, even though she had no idea where to send them. "If only we could get to that village, Elena," said Mrs. Rimmis one night in the ration line. "We could mail our letters." People who signed the 25-year sentence were able to go to the village. We were not. "Yes, we need to get to the village," I said, thinking of getting something to Papa.
"Send the whore, that Arvidus woman," said the bald man. "She'll hustle the best deals. Her Russian is probably pretty good by now."
"How dare you," said Mrs. Rimmis. "You disgusting old man, do you think she wants to sleep with them?" I yelled. "Her son's life depends on it." Jonas hung his head. "You should feel sorry for Mrs. Arvidus," said Mother, "just as we feel sorry for you. Andrus and Mrs. Arvidus have put extra food in your mouth many a night. How can you be so ungrateful?"
"Well, then you'll have to bribe that cranky cow who signed," said the bald man. "You can buy her off to mail your letters."
We had all written letters that Mother planned to mail to her contact, a distant relative who lived in the countryside. The hope was that Papa had done the same thing. We weren't able to sign our names or write anything specific. We knew the Soviets would read the notes. We wrote that we were all well, having a lovely time learning good trade skills. I drew a picture of Grandma and wrote "Love from Grandma Altai" underneath with my scribbled signature. Surely Papa would recognize the face, my signature, and the word Altai. Hopefully, the NKVD wouldn't. Chapter 42. Mother held 3 sterling silver serving pieces she had sewn into the coat. She had carried them since we were deported. "Wedding gifts," she said, holding the silver. "From my parents." Mother offered 1 piece to the grouchy woman in exchange for mailing letters and picking up sundries and news when she went to the village. She accepted. Everyone longed for news. The bald man told Mother of a secret pact between Russia and Germany. Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Poland and others were divided between Hitler and Stalin. I drew the 2 of them, dividing countries like children dividing toys. Poland for you, Lithuania for me. Was it a game to them? The bald man said Hitler broke his agreement with Stalin because Germany invaded Russia a week after we were deported. When I asked Mother how the bald man knew about the pact, she said she didn't know. What had happened to our house and everything we owned since we were deported? Did Joanna and my other relatives know what had happened? Maybe they were looking for us. I was glad that Hitler had pushed Stalin out of Lithuania. But what was he doing there?
Nothing could be worse than Stalin, said one of the men at the dining room table. He is the epitome of evil. There is no better or worse, said Papa, his voice low. I leaned farther around the corner to listen. But Hitler won't uproot us, said the man. Maybe not you, but what about us Jews? Said Dr. Seltzer, my father's close friend. You heard the circulation. Hitler made the Jews wear armbands.
Martin's right, said my father. And Hitler's setting up a system of ghettos in Poland.
A system? Is that what you call it, Custis? He's locked up hundreds of thousands of Jews in Lodz and sealed off even more in Warsaw, said Dr. Seltzer, his voice soaked with desperation.
It was a bad choice of words. I'm sorry, Martin, said Papa. My point is that we're dealing with two devils who both want to rule hell.
But Kostas, to remain neutral or independent will be impossible, said a man.
Lena, whispered Mother, grabbing me by my collar, go to your room.
I didn't mind. The constant talk of politics bored me. I was only listening for my drawing game. I tried to draw their expressions simply by hearing the conversation but not seeing their faces. I had heard enough to draw Dr. Seltzer. Jonas continued to work with the two Siberian women making shoes. They liked him. Everyone loved Jonas and his sweet disposition. The women advised that he'd best make boots for winter. They looked the other way when he set aside scraps of materials. Jonas was learning Russian much quicker than I was. He could understand a fair amount of conversation and could even use slang. I constantly asked him to translate. I hated the sound of the Russian language.
Chapter 43. I thrashed next to Mother in the beet field. Black boots appeared near my feet. I looked up. Kretzky. His yellow hair parted on the side and cascaded across his forehead. I wondered how old he was. He didn't look much older than Andrus. Vilkas, he said. Mother looked up. He rattled off something in Russian too quickly for me to understand. Mother looked down and then back at Kretzky. She raised her voice and yelled out to the field. They're looking for someone who can draw. I froze. They had found my drawings. Do any of you draw? She said, shading her eyes and looking across the field. What was Mother doing? No one responded. Kretzky's eyes narrowed, looking at me. They'll pay 2 cigarettes for someone to copy a map and a photograph. I'll do it, I said quickly, dropping my hoe.
No, Lina, said Mother, grabbing my arm.
Mother, a map, I whispered. Maybe it will bring us news of the war or the men, and I won't have to be in the field. I thought about giving a cigarette to Andrus. I wanted to apologize.
I'll go with her, said Mother in Russian.
Niet,
yelled Kretzky. He grabbed me by the arm.
Davai,
he yelled, pulling me away. Kretzky dragged me from the beet field. My arm ached under his grip. As soon as we disappeared from view, he let go of me. We walked in silence toward the Kolkhoz office. 2 NKVD approached down the row of shacks. One caught sight of us and shouted to Kretzky. He looked over to them, then back at me. His posture changed.
Davai! Yelled Kretzky.
He slapped me across the face. My cheek stung. My neck twisted from the unexpected blow. The 2 NKVD drew near, watching. Kretzky called me a fascist pig. They laughed. One of them asked for a match. Kretzky lit the guard's cigarette. The NKVD brought his face an inch from mine. He muttered something in Russian, then blew a long stream of smoke in my face. I coughed. He took the burning cigarette and pointed the glowing tip at my cheek.
Brown tar stains filled a crack between his front teeth. His lips were chapped and crusty. He stepped back, looking me over, nodding. My heart hammered. Kretzky laughed and slapped the guard on the shoulder. The other NKVD raised his eyebrows and made obscene gestures with his fingers before laughing and walking away with his friend. My cheek throbbed. Kretzky's shoulders dropped. He stepped back and lit a cigarette. Vilkas, he said, shaking his head and blowing smoke out of the corner of his mouth. He laughed, grabbed my arm, and dragged me toward the kolkhoz office. What had I just agreed to? Chapter 44. I sat at a table in the kolkhoz office. I shook out my hands, hoping to stop them from quivering. A map was placed to my upper left and a photograph to my upper right. The map was of Siberia, the photo of a family. In the photograph, a black box had been drawn around the man's head. An NKVD brought paper in a box with a nice selection of pens, pencils, and drafting supplies. I ran my fingers over the writing utensils, longing to use them for my own drawings. Kretzky pointed to the map. I had seen maps in school, but they had never interested me as much as this one did. I looked at the map of Siberia, shocked by its enormity. Where were we on the map? And where was Papa? I surveyed the details of the plot. Kretzky pounded his fist on the table, impatient. Several officers hovered around while I drew. They flipped through files and pointed to locations on the map. The files had papers and photographs affixed to them. I stared at the cities on the map as I was drawing, trying to commit them to memory. I would recreate it on my own later. Most of the officers left as soon as the map was finished. Kretzky flipped through files, drinking coffee while I drew the man in the photograph. I closed my eyes and inhaled. The coffee smelled incredible. The room was warm like our kitchen at home. When I opened my eyes, Kretzky was staring at me. He set his coffee cup down on the table, examining the drawing. I looked at the man's face as it came to life on my page. He had bright eyes and a warm smile. His mouth was relaxed and calm, not pinched like Miss Grebus or the bald man. I wondered who he was and whether he was Lithuanian. I thought about creating something his wife and children would like to look at. Where was this gentleman, and why was he important? The ink from the pen flowed smoothly. I wanted that pen. When Kretzky turned, I dropped it in my lap and leaned closer to the table. I needed texture to capture the man's hair. I dipped my finger into Kretzky's coffee cup, lifting the grounds onto my finger. I dabbed them on top of my other hand and swished the brown around on my skin. I used the coffee grounds to blot texture into the hair. Almost. I leaned forward and brushed a bit of the grit with my pinky. It curved softly in a gentle sweep. Perfect. I heard footsteps. Two cigarettes appeared in front of me. I turned, startled. The commander stood behind me. My skin prickled at the sight of him, bristling on my arms and the back of my neck.